Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with...
My name is Lauren Gunderson.
And she is the esteemed playwright of The Revolutionists, which is at the Everyman Theater up in Baltimore now through January 7th. Lauren, thanks so much for joining us.
It was such a pleasure.
Now, before we dive too far in, you and I both know what the premise is. Set during the French Revolution, we got Marie Antoinette, we got a playwright, we got a Caribbean spy, all this good stuff. But just for our listeners that don't know what it's about, just hit us with the quick premise real quick.
Sure. So it's actually based on a totally true story, which I found inspiring and shocking and just really curious. So that's why I wrote this play. So it's set in 1793. This is when the French Revolution is getting really bloody and everyone's turning against everyone. And so the characters you're going to meet, the main character is a playwright named Olympe de Gouges, who was a real playwright at this time, one of the very few female playwrights in French history, much less during this time. We're going to meet the famous and hilarious Marie Antoinette and Charlotte Corday, who is responsible for assassinating Jean-Paul Marat, and a character that's kind of an amalgam of historical characters named Marianne Angèle. She is an African Caribbean spy, is I suppose the right word, who is fighting for abolition.
How do you even stumble upon that idea? Did you read it somewhere and you said, oh my God, that's just begging to be adapted?
It really is. It's so full of suspense and humor and a really interesting, edgy kind of feminism, intersectionality. So really what happened was I've always been interested in the French Revolution. And I've always had my eye on Charlotte Corday, because who was this young girl who just has the, pardon my language, balls to go up to Jean-Paul Marat, this very famous political activist at the time, and stab him to death. Just stab him. I was, you know, I've always found that kind of, like, who is that girl? So adding the characters around this playwright, Olympe de Gouges, who was a feminist. She actually wrote the first feminist treatise even before Mary Wollstonecraft in England, who, for those of us who care about feminist history, she did that 10 years after Olympe de Gouges did in France. So there's all sorts of undiscovered history, corners in history, but it really became important to me when thinking about our current time in America and looking at this division between the wealthy and the poor, which was one of the drivers of the French Revolution, a distaste for authority, misogyny, racism. One of the things that was really profound to me was that France during this time was fighting for independence, liberté, égalité, while they had a slave colony in the Caribbean, and the discord of that, the hypocrisy of that. It felt like I could bring four women to represent the kind of corners of the various battles going on and really make something kind of beautiful, but also radically funny and really about revolution on every front.
Absolutely. And you touched on something really fascinating there with what you just said. You said the discord between those two concepts of being, you know, the revolutionaries fighting for freedom. Well, it was the same as the states. You know, we're all fighting for, all men are created equal, but then they're at the same time, they've somehow compartmentalized it, and then they have slaves, and women aren't treated equal, you know? So it's fascinating how those two things can coexist. And we're still dealing with it now, honestly. So.
Yeah, and I do think what's become really sensitive and really poignant for me right now with this play, which I began writing several years ago, but with this administration and its insistence on this fake news business, and there's so much hypocrisy and so much outright lying, that's really, in many ways, what the heart of this play is about and calls out the hypocrisy of people fighting for revolution in one corner of the world, but ignoring it in another, and, you know, being okay with certain kinds of activism and not with others. And so in many ways, that's what's become kind of a highlight of this play, an unintentional highlight with what's going on in our current society and how it reflects hundreds of years ago.
Absolutely. Now, I know you're based in San Francisco, but are you able to speak to this specific cast that's performing this in Baltimore?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. We work together virtually on Skype, among other things. and I basically rewrote the beginning of the play for them. They are such an amazing group of women and so funny that I was able to discover some new things and based on their really insightful ideas, just, you know, deepen the play, which I really love to do and to make it personal to a cast. So what you're going to see at Everyman is something very special and really written towards their strengths.
Absolutely. And just so I can list their names for the listeners, it's Megan Anderson, Beth Hilton, Emily Kester, and Dawn Ursula, who we know she came in studio for, I guess, when Arena Stage was doing Raisin in the Sun. So that's a nice foursome there. You said you've sort of been working with them over Skype, but is it the same with director Casey Stengel, or how? What has that collaboration been like?
Yeah, we've been talking for longer than the cast. So we've also been talking virtually, and she's been amazing and has really delved into a lot of the corners of the play and helped me see new things. And it's been a great collaboration.
Awesome. So we've talked a lot about, you know, the premise, the themes, the characters, how timely it is, all that stuff. But just from and remember, we're radio, so try to paint a picture visually if you can. But if our listeners come out to Everyman and they're sitting in their seats, what are they actually going to visually and audially, you know, experience, see on stage?
Yeah. So the main tone of the play, it's going to feel like this combination of what you might hear in 1793 and a really modern, edgy, rebellious kind of Tina Fey, Amy Poehler rolling kind of humor, which sounds like it doesn't fit in a bloody French Revolution. But I feel like that was the way to make it engaging, fast, funny, surprising. So you're going to see a lot of that, hear a lot of that. What you're going to see is beautiful costumes. I mean, we have Marie Antoinette, so you're gonna see Marie Antoinette. and the costumes are just luscious and I think quite exciting. The set, I think, is beautiful. There's a bit of a haunting to it. There's something kind of ominous about the set, which as the play goes on, you'll see why it deserves that. So there's something always coming in the play. And it's really fast and quick paced. And you may think that you know what's going to come, but I think we've got some surprises for you.
I'm with you. I know you say like it doesn't seem the French Revolution that it could be a comedy, but I think it could. Instead of you know, let them eat cake, it's let them eat a pie in the face.
There you go. Sure, I'll take that any day.
We'll take it. All right. Now, did I also read you might, in addition to Everyman, that you're going to be performing a couple select scenes at the Kennedy Center this month too?
The cast is going to. Yeah. Okay. They're performing at the Kennedy Center, so you get to have a sneak peek if you're anywhere near there.
That's awesome. So do you personally know how that actually got set up? Or I guess I could ask the folks at Everyman for that, too.
Yeah, I think Everyman has a relationship with them. And the Kennedy Center is so wonderful about opening their beautiful lobby. And lobby isn't the right word. It's like an atrium, really. Yeah. It's so gorgeous and kind of hallowed space for the arts. So they offer it to various artistic organizations for concerts and dance and theater. So they are taking advantage of that, which is really quite an honor.
Absolutely. Now, The Revolutionist is just one of your many dozens and dozens of plays that have been produced lately. In fact, this is sort of this year is your moment. I mean, the New Yorker called you America's most popular playwright. American Theater Magazine just, I think they tallied it up and found that you're going to be the most produced playwright of the 2017-2018 season. Are you feeling like you're riding a wave right now?
it's deeply gratifying and really exciting. It's inspiring. I mean, I'm a kind of writer that the more that I get to work with companies on plays, I want to write more plays. So it's very inspiring, and it's damn cool. Pretty dang awesome.
It is very damn cool. I think you're even that doesn't say how cool it is. It's very, very damn cool. I think their survey tally excluded Shakespeare, but
of course.
But other than that, I think you beat out, you know, the August Wilsons, Eugene O'Neill, some real titans. So what's it like to even be considered in that company?
I mean, it's insane. It's crazy. Absolutely nuts. But I hope that it starts to speak to a changing landscape in American theater and how we are counting on and excited about women's voices, not just my own. The other people on that list of top 10 include some of America's finest playwrights, half of whom are women. So we get Lisa Crone and Dominique Morceau. And so it really is a time, I think, not just for me, but for a lot of female voices, which have had a harder go at being heard in the last, you know, forever. So now we can prove that we are powerful writers, funny writers, writers of a lot of wit and heart and soul. And it's really an honor to help lead that charge.
Absolutely. And just to piggyback off of that, it's so great that you are sort of, you know, that, I mean, you're on top of the mountain right now, but at the same time, I think I saw a stat that men still write 3/4 of the plays that ultimately get produced. So, how far away are we from that actually getting more, you know, on equal footing? And what are some of the, like, how do we get there?
I mean, I'm an optimist, so I'm gonna say we're close. And, you know, part of that is a recognition that the audience for theater is oftentimes more than 60% women. They're the ones who buy the tickets and organize and get people there. So in many ways, the decision makers for a performing art like theater, but it includes dance and opera as well, and all that, is a lot of time the drivers are women. So really figuring out, I think embracing the idea that Hamlet is a play, and a play perhaps by me might be miscategorized as a female play. So, you know, really trying to even the way that we even describe plays and say that the Revolutionist is a universal play, even though it's about four women, it is an absolutely universal play about how art matters, about revolution, about crisis, about brother and sisterhood, about righteous morality in the face of depravity and danger. And that's not something that is defined by sex. So I hope that the more plays by women you see, the more you'll see that we don't even need the qualifier of who wrote it. It's a play for all of us, and then speaks to humanity, not just half of humanity at a time.
That's such a great way of looking at it, you know, because it's always like hailed as the great female written play. No, it's just a great play. You know what I mean?
A great play.
Yeah, exactly. But I guess along those similar lines, I have to ask you too. I mean, we've not even, to even call it a tipping point is underselling it. I mean, we've seen a seismic shift, tidal wave with all of the allegations that have gone on from Harvey Weinstein to, you know, Fox News to the Today Show. I mean, it's penetrating every industry. Not even entertainment. But do you think that will help? You know, once sort of the dust settles from all of this, which will probably be years and maybe even decades from now, do you think that's going to clear the way and open some more opportunities for not only women playwrights and filmmakers, but younger folks that maybe weren't in those positions of power before?
Definitely, definitely. And I'll tell you why, because when you look at the Harvey Weinstein stuff and all of the stuff in media, it's not just their personal behavior. It's the stories that they brought into the world and put forth as the stories that deserve our attention. And so often those stories have minimal roles for women. Even if there are female characters, they often speak, you know, a quarter of what the male characters do. They're often in some form of undress. Their part is to support the male characters and not to have their own agency. And those are the stories that I grew up on, that we all did. And, you know, so part of what happens when you allow women to tell stories that define not just themselves, but the human experience, not the female experience, but the human experience, is you get to pop those myths and say, no, there is agency beyond who you marry and, you know, who gets to own you at the end of the story. So that's part of what we're seeing now, is when you have women's, an entire half of humanity doesn't get to be a hero. And now we're starting to see that there are ways for them to be a hero, more than just a few ways. There are numerous, innumerable ways to really embrace the female experience as something exciting and deeply relevant and profound. That's part of what I'm seeing with these oustings and with this sea change that we're in the middle of politically, through entertainment, through journalism. I mean, up and down every category of human interaction, we're finally being able to say, no, you don't get to define women. You wouldn't want to be defined if all of this was reversed and it were men who were unable to keep a job because of harassment, or to escalate in their career because of bias against them. It wouldn't be so strange to say, well, I don't understand why these women are so upset. Well, of course you would. If this was happening to you, you would understand. And we're finally able to articulate it and to say, hell no, we're not doing this anymore. Which is part of what The Revolutionist is really about, is four women representing very distinct parts of society, all coming together and saying, no, this is not, we're not going to live in a world where this is something that we agree to. So we're not going to agree anymore. We're going to change it. We're going to fight for it. And we're going to fight together. And to borrow Hillary Clinton's campaign slogan, that it's we're stronger together. And no matter where we come from or what race we are, or what class we are, it's always better when we're together.
Love it. Couldn't have said it better myself. All right. I want to know, we've talked a lot about your more recent career, but take it all the way back. Growing up in Atlanta, how did you first get bitten by the bug? Either, you know, did you put on plays in the living room for mom and dad, or was it a theater arts teacher, or kind of what did it?
Yeah, I always wanted to be an actor when I was little. And so that definitely included forcing my sister to sing various Lion King musical numbers around the backyard and in the living room. And so she will never let me forget that.
Did you hold her up in the air like Simba?
I did. I was a little too small to do that. But if I could have, I would have. We used, you know, dolls and stuffed animals instead. We're very clever. So I started on that performance end, which I think a lot of theater people start on that when you get the stage. And it's this strange feeling of power and vulnerability. And like, what is this? And it becomes you're a bit of an addict for that stage presence. And then I realized, you know, as I acted a little bit more and more, I realized, well, the real power is with the writer, because they're the ones who decides who's the hero, why are they the hero, what do they learn, what's the entire story about. So that became my second addiction, being the one who was like, no, I think I want a little more control than actor has. Also, acting is super hard, and I have deep respect for people who do it every night. I can't imagine it. So switched to writing, and then the question was, well, what do you write about? If you want to write, fine, but what is worth gathering people for a few hours at a time and having them listen to whatever you think. And that's when I started diving into history and finding these core moments, these critical turning points throughout time, where I feel like we can dive in, and there's a bit of time travel to writing a history play, which I love. And it really gives us a pretty clear perspective on where we are and who we are now, that sometimes you can't do, even if you're writing in a very edgy modern play.
Well, past is prologue, and honestly, to me, time, what I love about not only your work, but just other, you know, sort of historical or time travel type stuff is, you know, like, time is almost like an illusion, you know, like, history can be erased, and you sit there and watch it, and, where I mean, things that happened in the past, if we got to learn those lessons to figure out, you know, where we are now and where to go, so that's what, you know, hats off to you for that. Take me, when you started pursuing it a little more seriously, you know, I know you got in undergrad, you went to Emory University, did English and Creative Writing, and then you went to NYU to get your MFA in Dramatic Writing. How did those sort of years shape you at both of those schools?
I mean, it's hard not to be inspired and enlightened when you live in New York and you aim to be a playwright. So I saw every show I could manage to afford or sneak into. NYU's Tisch School for where I studied dramatic writing taught me how to write for TV as well as film. And of course, my main focus was theater. So learning all of those crafts really helped me be a dramatist. It helped me understand the possibilities of theater, you know, seeing some incredible plays that I would never write, because that is just not how I think, but it's so deeply inspiring. So I learned as much as I could there and wrote as much as I could, and came out on the other side really confident in dramatic structure, which sounds super boring, but it really is still my obsession, is why do we tell stories this way? What primal sensibility has been driven into us as human beings that makes us so enamored by stories, they're so magnetic to us as creatures all over the planet, all over the culture, in every culture, all over the world.
What is the answer to that, though? Why do you think that is? Why has it been drilled down so almost in a collective subconscious level that we need these stories like this?
It's actually our biology. It's evolution has rolled out the human creature with a really big brain and a really high social awareness. So we are the most social species on the planet, and we're the smartest. So those two things combined make us love fiction, and especially stories about each other. Because what that does is it's a very efficient way to learn things and to retain wisdom. Big ideas, small ideas, we make those bits of wisdom really funny, which helps them be memorable, really sad and gory, really exciting. And all of that, we use really high emotional stakes, which those always, those are very magnetic to other human beings. We kind of want to know, why is she laughing so hard? Why are they crying so hard? So it really is the most efficient way to convey really important information for our survival. And so over time, that is the thing that is easy to do. You don't actually need much to tell a story. You can just have a person and say, hey, I'm going to tell you a story. You don't, you know, there's no other technology beyond that. So I've spent a lot of time figuring out, trying to ask, you know, what's the primal genesis of storytelling? And why do we watch everything from Game of Thrones and Avengers movies? But we're still watching Hamlet, and we're still reading those Greek plays and, you know, incredible epic poems. And all over the world, we tell stories to each other because stories help us be better human beings to each other, to the world around us. I think that's what makes them not only so enjoyable, but so powerful and so important to support.
I love that you're such a student of the biology or in the anthropology and the history of this, rather than just, you know, you sit down and it's just an instinctive gift you have. I like that you've actually spent some mental and spiritual energy, you know, trying to to grapple where it comes
from.
Every
way I can. Super nerd.
No, it's great. And I'm sure it has a profound impact on how you write, too. Tell me about your, you had a 3-year Mellon Foundation for residency at the Marin Theater?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, that gives me basically a home. And it's been really cool because I get to one of the ways I've used this residency here in the Bay Area is to get together the same group of actors every month or two and read whatever I've written in that month. And so it keeps this development really active, really fresh. I surround myself by amazing artists that make me better at what I do. So that's been a real gift. And thanks the Mellon Foundation for that chance.
All right. Final couple seconds here. In closing, advice for other up and coming playwrights or even screenwriters, storytellers, like you're saying, it kind of crosses disciplines, but just other, you know, other writers out there that have something to be heard. How do they, I guess, hone their message in a way that is, you know, that can be expressed to, you know, to audiences, but also how can they have their stuff seen? I feel like it's a struggle for a lot of creatives out there.
Yeah, it is. I mean, part of it comes with seeing everything you can, reading everything you can, and reaching out to each other. I mean, theater is a personal business. So if you really see a play you love at Everyman or at Arena or at Roundhouse Theater, where my other play, The Book of Will, is on right now in Bethesda, you reach out to the director, to the literary manager, to the playwright and say, I really liked what you did. And maybe that'll start a conversation that can end up in some sort of mentorship or you know, some conversation that can be meaningful to everybody. So I think that's one thing. The second thing is to really write about big, important stuff. Like, let's not write about people breaking up in their apartment and they're like 20 years old and they drink too much. Like, all right, I'm not sure the world needs that. What does the world need that is just pattern breaking and genre breaking? Something that really has high stakes. And it is, you know, writing something that has a timelessness to it or an attempt at timelessness, I think, is a real thing. And if you accomplish that, people will certainly pay attention.
I love it so much. You've been more than generous with your time. Thank you so much for everything. Final question. You're not allowed to say the revolutionists at Everyman or the Book of Will at Roundhouse. Those are the two local ones. Everybody come out and see those. But looking back over all of your theaterography, which are you most proud of? You got to pick one.
I will say it's a very small little play called I and You. And what I love about it is, as much as I love writing history, big plays with a lot of, you know, crazy heart and wildness. This one is a really simple play about two teenagers doing homework, which sounds like the most boring thing in the world. But I'm really proud of what I was able to accomplish in terms of a really kind of titanic surprise at the end. I usually love that play because it makes people laugh and then really weep at the end and gasp. So I'm most proud of that one because the structure is really tight. It's like a music box. And I really like doing a lot with a little.
Awesome. Well, we had a little time here, and you did a lot with it. So thank you so thank you so much for joining us, everyone. It's again, that's Lauren Gunderson, the writer of The Revolutionists at Everyman Theater in Baltimore. Lauren, thanks so much. You've been great.
Such a pleasure. Thanks a lot.